This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This month on Cadenza, we've been featuring a wide variety of pianists, and we'll wrap this series up by chatting with one of America's most respected and talented artists, though at times she has flown under the radar, Anne Marie McDermott. She has been an award winner in her concert career, such as the Avery Fisher Career Development Award, a prize winner in major competitions, and a Grammy Award winner for her recordings. Her vast repertoire has her championing contemporary composers all the way back to music of the 18th century. She is also at the helm of the prestigious Bravo Vale Music Festival in that ski summer resort town in Colorado, celebrating its 30th anniversary this summer. For this major milestone, she's presenting major orchestras from Chicago, Philadelphia, and Dallas, including premieres of works commissioned by the festival specifically for this anniversary. You're listening to her as soloist with the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, here led by Justin Brown, in the final minutes of George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm Variations. This year's festival also features seven top string quartets and much, much more, as you'll hear. I met up with my guest at her apartment in New York City a few weeks back.
The many pianists I've had, first of all, it's great to have you on the program. Pianists I've had over the years, this is going to be the first Cadenza I've had with a pianist where I'm going to have the first question, which is not about your piano playing.
Oh my goodness, okay,
because,
I'm ready.
I want to be indirectly about your piano playing. You are the artistic director of the Bravo Vale Music Festival in Colorado, which is celebrating 30 years, which is amazing for a festival or anything these days in the arts to make it 30 years.
It is, especially
the climate we have. This is a festival which has some small market bands come, called the New York Philharmonic and the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Dallas Symphony, this unknown group from across the water called the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, some really top-notch, I'm being facetious, but some top-notch chamber ensembles and string quartets, of which you're playing. And you're also this year premiering a work by someone who's been a past Cadenza guest, but who's institutionally worked with all the time, which is David Ludwig from Curtis.
Nice.
So, first of all, tell us more about what's happening, because I just gave the highlights, and then I'll have a follow-up question. So tell us about this 30th anniversary.
Okay.
It's exciting.
Oh, it's thrilling. I started at the Bravo Festival in 2011.
Okay.
So this will be my seventh summer being there, so I feel like I understand the place a lot more in depth now than when I started, certainly. But I'm always learning. We had one founding executive director at Bravo Vale for 25 years, John Giovando. He started this thing. The first year, he always tells this great story, there were more musicians on stage than there were in the audience.
Right.
And now we attract somewhere around 60,000 people every summer who come through the festival. So, you know, there's a program that I started 2 years ago that is incredibly dear to my heart, being a obsessive piano player, and it's called Piano Fellows, where I invite two youngish pianists who I feel like, you know, they're just at the beginning stages of their careers, to come out and spend 2 weeks, kind of just be my shadows. We go everywhere together. They play concerts. They collaborate with each other. They collaborate with some other chamber music artists. They go to all the orchestral concerts. It's when I look back decades ago when I was a young artist and having an opportunity like this, I really wanted to like be able to pass that along. And so it's been really exciting for me having this program.
Well, who are the two this year?
So this year, I'm particularly excited, actually. These are both former Curtis students, actually. Jenny Chen, she graduated Curtis at 18, then went on and got her master's at Yale, and now she's getting her doctor's at Eastman, and she's a whopping 22 years old.
Mm.
Incredible pianist, mind-boggling. And then another recent Curtis grad, Chelsea Wang, and Chelsea's getting ready. Next year, she's going to go to Peabody and study with Leon Fleischer.
Mm.
So they're just extraordinary young talents and people. So they'll be with us for 2 weeks. So I'm thrilled about that. You know, every year my cohort is a woman by the name of Jacqueline Taylor. She's the director of artistic planning. You know, and it's, as you can imagine, a gigantic jigsaw puzzle. It's mind-boggling whenever we start up each August. It's like, oh my God, where do we start? But it just so happened through the course of all our programming that we're doing 5 premieres this summer, but we're also having 7 string quartets. We didn't, like, a year ago set out to say, oh, it's the year of the string quartet, but it just so happened that as we were programming, it came to our attention that the Emerson Quartet had a window of time when they could join us. It's their first time coming, so that's amazing. The New York Philharmonic recently formed a string quartet, the New York Philharmonic String Quartet, with the 4 principals, with Frank Wong and Cheryl Staples and Cindy Phelps and Carter Bray. And then we're having the Calder String Quartet, who've been with us many times in the past.
That's who you're doing the Ludwig with.
That's who I'm doing the Ludwig with.
Yeah, they were guests of mine years ago. Great, great young players.
The great young players.
Amazing.
Yeah, and so...
And West Coast based.
And West Coast based.
So many
and,
East Coast Brooklyn based.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Well, actually, we're having another quartet that's West Coast based as well called the Lyris Quartet, and they'll be joining us, and the Aeolus String Quartet, the Zora, a young string quartet based here in New York. So that kind of happened. And then, you know, just every year we have a series that closes the festival, which is also something I just love so much because it's a little more outside the box. It's called Classically Uncorked, and that's where we're going to premiere the David Ludwig piece. His work is called Pangea, but that's a series, 3 nights in a row, a more intimate environment. We serve great wine. It's going to be Arietta wine and delicious hors d'oeuvres and play more outside-the-box repertoire. Mm-hmm. So, you know, not just standard classical chamber music. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had Room Full of Teeth in the past. We've had, I'm forgetting the name. We've had a couple of percussion quartets. We had Doug Perkins out there last summer.
Was so out there?
No, we didn't have, not yet.
Okay.
Not yet.
They'll be game.
Oh, you know what? It was Third Coast Percussion.
There you go.
Third Coast. Yeah.
So this kind of brings the what's in vogue, what should be in vogue, sort of the non-traditional venue platform to the festival.
Yes.
By doing this.
Yeah. You know, it's a very traditional... Have you ever been out to Vail?
I've been to Vail, not to the festival.
Okay. So you know it's a unbelievably beautiful place, right? In the High Rockies, it's stunning. You know, in a more traditional aesthetic. Mm-hmm. So I always wanted to just shake it up in ways that I felt were appropriate to a summer resort community. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's not New York City,
right.
So I'm not going to program it like it is. However, there is room for some more experimental things. We started another series, 4 years ago, called Bravo After Dark, and I get the biggest kick out of this. Do you want to guess what time is after dark in Bravo, in Vail, Colorado?
11:30?
You're so not a summer resort mountain community guy. 8:30 at night.
Oh, 8:30. I thought you meant like when the sun sets. I'm figuring it's big, sets later out there.
Well, no, it does set later, but we call the series Bravo After Dark, but it happens at 8:30. And what we do,
which is bizarre coming from New York, which never...
Are you kidding me? I don't even eat dinner at 8:30. I mean, I'm about 10 o'clock. But... what we do is we go into ale houses and breweries.
Okay.
This is nothing revolutionary that we're doing. It's happening across the country. But to be doing it in a summer resort community is very cool. And right off the bat, we attracted audiences, you know, hooting and hollering and wild and crazy, drinking beer, listening to classical music. So it's...
I should mention the 3 big American orchestras mentioned have premieres of works written for them, which they're premiering. And then I think even Joshua Bell now heads up the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. I think he's doing a new piece too brings over that group from England.
Exactly.
How did you fall into it? Did you want to do this? Did it fall in your lap?
The commissioning?
No, just being the director.
Right? Oh, okay. That's a really good question. It was nothing I ever in my wildest dreams dreamed of doing.
Yeah.
Certainly not a festival of this scope. Not in a million years. And you can't go take a course in how to be an artistic director. And I'm very happily ensconced playing concerts. The position opened up, so the then executive director, John Giovando, he approached me, but he approached like 80 other people about, you want to just do an interview. So I didn't even want to do that much. And my husband and my father both said to me, Annie, you know what? Just do the interview. Give it some time. The whole process, they were having like a 6-month search. Uh-huh. So I did that first interview. I was a nervous wreck. I mean, I don't get that nervous playing concerts. I was a wreck. But I really enjoyed the interview, and I enjoyed getting ready for the interview by looking at the festival and kind of dreaming of, oh, what would I bring to this? Do I have anything to bring to this, right? So I actually took one long weekend, got a big flip chart, and plotted out a whole season. I still have this gigantic flip chart piece of paper. A lot of it is probably never doable, mm-hmm. but I just wanted to see what would it feel like. And I did something, this is, again, before I had the job. Everything had a cross connection. There were themes running through the whole thing. Then I came down to earth.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got invited back for a second interview. By that point, I was starting to get intrigued by the whole concept. They offered me the job, and then I, you know, I sat in a chair for 2 days comatose, like, what the hell did I just do?
Right.
And then got busy, and I can't believe it's been 7 years, to tell you, I really can't.
Double back to the commissions, because the Vogue right now are co-commissions, which does help mm-hmm. with costs and such, but these major orchestras, is each commission contained within that group's, I mean, is the piece that the Dallas is doing, the commission for the Dallas Symphony, is it run through Bravo, or does it run through
Dallas? Good question, of course. We are the sole commissioner. We wanted to make a statement to our community in Vail, Colorado, our patrons, our board. We wanted to make a statement of our devotion to the importance of commissioning,
right.
of giving birth to new pieces of music. The festival has a history of doing commissions, but not in any big way. Just a commission each summer. So the program hasn't yet had the gravitas that it needs. So what better way than an anniversary season to just jump in? We have some incredibly generous patrons in Vail and the surrounding area. So we were able to have the funding for it. Then the fun part was actually talking to each of the orchestras and deciding upon a composer. You know, because everybody has, it's subjective, right? I have my favorites. Everybody has their favorites. So we chose for Dallas that we're going to have Roberto Sierra, who I just love. Philadelphia Orchestra, that premiere is being conducted by Stéphane Deneuve, and he's a big champion of this French composer, Guillaume Canessan. So that's that work. New York Philharmonic, in conversations with them, we all settled on young woman, Julia Adolph. And then I have to say, I made the David Ludwig thing because I just adore David Ludwig. The Academy, that's the one that's a co-commission. And that's being written, makes sense, by Edgar Meyer. And Edgar and Josh have a long history together. So Josh was very excited about that. And that'll be more of a concerto for Josh with the Academy. So it's cool how it all came together.
Yeah, and American composers, I mean, Canessan is not. But Leonard Slatkin just brought a piece of his with the Orchestre de Lyon to Carnegie Hall. I was at the concert a number of months ago now. It was a very interesting piece.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
you know, as soon as it was suggested to us, then I did a bunch of listening, and I really loved his voice.
Yeah.
Very fresh, very energetic, full of life. It's going to be such a fun journey this season, you know, to have. And, you know, there's still some trepidation with our audiences out there about new pieces of music. Mm. But I feel like we've been making progress. You know, I'm a big fan of Charles Warren. And I had commissioned Charles Warren to write his fourth piano sonata for me with Town Hall here in New York. And I premiered it probably almost 10 years ago now. So I actually programmed it out in Vail. And I surrounded it by Haydn sonatas on this classically uncorked, this little more cutting edge series. People loved it. So, you know.
Well, things are changing. You never know. I mean, this is all in celebration of the 30th year, but you might create a climate where they expect a new piece.
I know.
So they're part of that excitement of a premiere.
Well,
that's
the goal. That's the goal, is for people to realize that when you listen to a brand new piece of music, first of all, you don't have to understand it on one listening. I'm a musician. This is all I do with my life. Most of the time, I don't completely understand it. Secondly, you don't have to like it.
Right.
You're allowed to not like something,
yeah.
you know? But the fun thing is giving birth to it,
right.
is to experiencing this for the first time.
And people do really enjoy. I mean, they were the first performance of this.
Yes.
And what if the piece lives on for years? I can say, I was there.
Oh, wow, come on.
Yeah.
Somebody had to be the first
Somebody
performance of Beethoven's Fifth, right? I mean...
Here here is my guest, Anne-Marie McDermott, as soloist in the final movement from Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 14 in E-flat major, Kreutzer Listing 449. Not the orchestral version, but rather the pared-down chamber version for string quartet and piano. My guest is accompanied by one of those dynamic quartets being featured at her Bravo Vale Music Festival's 30th anniversary celebration this summer, past Cadenza guests, the Calder Quartet. Thank you.
Yes, we must. We must. Okay.
You've been called a pianist's pianist.
Oh, that's
one
nice.
One of the great American pianists over the age of 40, all this kind of stuff. Having all those accolades and stuff, you still stuck to principles of carrying a very wide repertoire, I think, for a pianist of your rank. And it includes new music, as you've talked about. How did you, in the course of your, how did you come to that stance that I'm going to keep the vista's open, I'm going to present new things, I'm going to present a wide range of things instead of honing in and being a specialist or something like
that? Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's my desire to constantly, and I know a lot of pianists have this as well, to constantly be kind of feeding my pianistic soul and ego. So when I say ego, certain pieces, like right now, I'm learning Beethoven Opus 111. I'm playing it out in Vail this summer. I've never played it before. So, but, you know, my checklist, my bucket list of pieces, the Goldberg Variations, it's... But I realized some years back when I did the whole cycle of Prokofiev piano sonatas that, like, 2 years of my life, that's all I was doing was playing Prokofiev because I recorded it, all of them as well. And going through that process was extraordinary. And starting the process and having... It was like climbing Mount Everest. Coming out the other side, having recorded them all, having played them all in concerts, it changed me as a musician, I think as a person as well. So I'm always trying to balance my desire to go really deep with one composer. Like now I've embarked on a project of recording all the Haydn piano sonatas. Okay. So I love to do those intensive, really, so like when you say you avoided being a specialist, but what I'm not avoiding is really sinking my teeth into certain composers in a very comprehensive way. But I think I play Haydn better because I've played Warren, and I play, you know, Bach better because I've played Prokofiev Eighth Sonata. Right. And, you know, I mean, I really think everything feeds everything else, and I play solo repertoire better because I play so much chamber music and vice versa.
Right.
You know, so for me, I thrive on having a broad variety of repertoire.
And your pianist isn't afraid. Not that I'm saying pianists are, but a lot of pianists are, you know, they're not as quick as maybe some of the younger ensembles, like a string quartet, who will now juxtapose a Beethoven, late Beethoven quartet against a brand new piece, because they feel that there's that dynamic nature going on.
Yeah.
But you have, in your recordings and recitals, programmed something very new against something very established.
Yes. Yes.
It's, that perspective has to be there.
Yeah. It's fascinating when, you know, like I say, with the Warren and Haydn juxtaposition back to back, it was fascinating. There was a program I was doing at one point, which was the last three Haydn sonatas paired with the first three Beethoven sonatas, which were written in concurrent years.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating because it makes the Haydn seem so revolutionary and the Beethoven so kind of sedate and predictable, and, you know, so it's so much fun to kind of look at things with fresh eyes, and you know. It's also, can I just also say that I'm a glutton for the pleasure of being a pianist. The repertoire is incredible.
It's immense.
It's immense, so how would you not? I always joke that I'll be laying on my deathbed with a big, long list of repertoire I still want to learn, you know.
But also the fact that you will play new music for instance.
Yes.
A pianist wouldn't have to do that. They
no.
wouldn't have to touch anything written in their lifetime if they wanted to.
That's true.
It's a very successful career.
Yeah. But you know what? We can't call up Beethoven on the phone and ask him questions.
No.
And with David Ludwig, I can shoot him an email. He'll be out with me in Vail.
Yeah.
And ask any number of questions. And I've worked with Roberto Sierra pretty closely over the years as well. And having that interaction with a composer also is something I learn a ton from, you know, so I wouldn't want to miss out on that.
A little about you. Grew up in a musical family, both your sisters, musicians, the Dermot Trio.
Yep.
Your mom was an Irish dancer. You made your Carnegie debut at 12. And then a couple years later, your mom passes away.
Yep.
Age 15.
Yep.
Talk about some of the people that were really important in getting you over things at that point, where you were already an accomplished pianist. I just said you were 3 years earlier on the stage at Carnegie Hall. But now this happens to you. So talk about some of the important people that helped you.
Absolutely.
Get past that.
Well, you know, what was interesting is a month and a half before my mom died, I was at the Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow with my sister, Carrie. Carrie was competing. I was accompanying her. And I actually got an award for best accompanist, which was very sweet. And it was a shock when we lost her. So I really completely lost my way and my footing, completely. Yeah. I stopped playing entirely because I hadn't yet, even though I was accomplished and precocious, I hadn't actually really established my own relationship with the music and with what I was doing. I was a good child. Right. I was an obedient child. And so I was following the path laid out in front of me, but I had no clue what path I was on.
Right.
So I really left music. I rebelled. I turned into a wild child. I was not a good human being at all. So there were a couple of friends who were critical. My sisters tried, but they were more together about the situation than I was. I really lost it. And it took some time. I barely touched the piano for like 2 years. And then I had to make money because I had moved into the city. I had left my father's house on Long Island and moved into the city. And so I started accompanying everybody on the planet because I knew so much of the repertoire and I was a very fast learner so that I could start having money to live on. Because
right.
My dad didn't give me anything when I left home. And really the monumental thing that absolutely changed my life forever was Susan Wadsworth and Young Concert Artists. Again, I was accompanying everybody for their juries at Manhattan School of Music. I had, when I was 17, I had gone to Manhattan School Prep. I applied for the college. They weren't very nice to me. They said, you know, we're not giving you any scholarship, but sure, you can go to the college. I went for 6 months. I got thrown out because I was a wild child. And Susan approached me because I was accompanying people for YCA. And she said, why don't you audition yourself? And I did the next year. And I won, and it changed my life completely. Because right away, when you win Young Concert Artists, you get a bunch of concerts. You know, that's what they do. They're a management. And I didn't own a gown. Susan actually got Alice Tully herself to pay for my first gown. So I had a gown for my New York debut. Then Susan made me go speak to the chairman of the board of Young Concert Artists, and because I didn't have a piano,
right.
And ask him for $5,000 to help me buy a Baldwin that Susan had found that I could buy for $5,000. And so, of course, he agreed. Susan knew he'd agreed, but she made me go through the process. So that got my life back. I'm grateful for everything I went through, because then the fact that I stopped studying altogether when I was 17, I never studied with anybody ever again, was, in a way, a great thing for me. Because, like I said, I was too good a student. So I tell me to play it like that, okay, I'll play it like that. But I wasn't making the decisions. I wasn't making my commitment, figuring out this piece of music. So it really made my relationship with what I do profoundly deeper. You know, it really did. And
it's hard to say, but if things had were not how they played out.
Yeah.
You'd be a different artist?
Oh, I would. I don't know what would have happened, to tell you the truth. And, of course, we can't know these things. But I'm not a religious person, but I'm a very spiritual person. And I believe things happen for a reason. And I believe, you know, my mother actually gave me a great gift. Through losing her, I gained a ton of strength. Do I wish I still had her? God, yes. You know, there's so many things that I've accomplished in my life that I wish... But I had my father, I just lost my father like 3 years ago. And I'm incredibly close to my two sisters.
Okay.
So we're a real tight unit.
Yeah, still performed together.
Yeah.
Another finale from a classical period 18th century piano concerto, this from Franz Joseph Haydn's Piano Concerto in G Major. The Odense Symphony Orchestra is led by Scott Yu. The cadenza is composed by American composer Charles Wuorinen. The soloist, my guest today, Anne-Marie McDermott. Thank you.
member participant of the Chamber Music Society at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
You still do performances as solos with orchestra. You have a whole recital career. You have the complete panoply of what it is to be a concert artist. You know, when younger pianists or younger artists, when they talk to you about how do I balance this?
Yeah.
What do you tell them? How do you balance all those three?
Yeah, for one thing, the most important thing I've learned is to know yourself and how you function. Like, I had to really learn, how long does it take me, Annie, to learn a piece of music? Not somebody else. It happens, I am a fast learner, but that doesn't apply to all repertoire. So I've learned to give myself more time. Prioritizing, compartmentalizing. That's how I function now. It's the only way I could function. So number one is piano playing. Okay, my day, if I don't practice first, I'm a witch, and I know that about myself. So I think there's a right time for everything. Mm-hmm. Don't try and take on too much before you can handle it. When I took on being the artistic director at Bravo, it was a major leap. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. But it was a good time in my life where I had the confidence to believe that I could do it. And so you're allowed to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. Mistakes, we learn from them. But I think it's kind of knowing yourself well and what you can handle.
But, if you were advising a young artist, are there points in a career? Do you have to establish the solo repertoire or have those band of five warhorse concertos under your belt? The careers have changed too now.
So very much.
It's not the same.
It's not.
As when you were
doing
this. And they all say, I love playing chamber music, but it would seem like a hard thing to balance into.
Very much. And I went through a real battle early in my career of people around me saying, stop playing chamber music because people are going to perceive you as a chamber music artist only. Mm-hmm. They're not going to hire you for charity. And at that time, this was probably 30 years ago, at that time, I think that was more true. And I listened to the manager for a period of time, but I also knew if I stopped playing chamber music, I wouldn't be the pianist that I wanted to be because I need chamber music. It feeds my soul. And because I stopped studying so young, I have learned the most, I think, from colleagues. I'm constantly learning from colleagues who give me comments and what, you know what I mean? So that has really fed me. Nowadays, I think it's much more expected that young pianists play chamber music. Thank God. It's crazy for pianists not to play chamber music. It's a crime, right? Because you learn so much from it. The repertoire is incredible. All of that. It's so hard to know what to recommend to young people these days.
May it help that you were in a household with two sisters who you could play chamber music.
Oh, it was built into my life. I had no choice.
Yeah,
I had no choice. I had to play chamber music.
Right.
I had no choice. Yeah. I had to play all the concerti with my sister Carrie, all the orchestral reductions.
Right.
You know, I didn't have a choice. But I'm grateful now because it made me a musical carnivore to a certain extent. But the other part of it too, I think having a career is a combination of things. Okay, talent, sure. Hard work, I can't say enough about hard work. You have to work your butt off every day. You have to. What's that? The harder that you work, the more freedom you can have. Then there's also luck. And I got lucky when Susan Wadsworth entered my life. I got lucky when David Schifrin decided to invite me to become an artist member of the Chamber Music Society. I'll never forget it. I was on vacation up in the Adirondacks, and I got a phone call. He had tracked me down to invite me. I practically fell on the floor. It was like the honor was so huge.
Wow.
You know, I look at a pianist like Jenny Chen, okay? She's 23 now. She's entered a couple of competitions. She has not had success at competitions. She's an extraordinary artist, huge talent, and she works like crazy. I have full confidence that Jenny Chen is going to have a very important career. Does she have the career started in a big way by the age of 23? No. Is that okay? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more she plays in public and people hear her, people are taking notice of her.
Right.
You know, my career wasn't overnight by long shot. My career has been a gradual, it really has.
Well, and there's so many paths now. Social media and the internet have made so many paths for any artist to be successful.
Yes.
However they're going to define that.
However, you know how I define success of a career in music? Longevity.
Yeah.
I really do. To me, the fact that I've been playing concerts and that things are never better than they are now, 30 years in. I'm just getting ready tomorrow. I'm heading off to Fort Worth to judge the Van Cliveren competition, which I have never done before. And it's going to be fascinating. It's 30 young pianists. My heart is going to go out for them every single second that they're on stage. Because I was lucky. I didn't do a lot of competitions. But the competitions don't have the gravitas.
No, I mean, there's so many elements of it, the recording contracts and the concert gigs, and some of them have it, but some of them just, it's not going to guarantee anything.
It doesn't guarantee anything, and, you know, I think this trend these days with social media of, you know, you blow your nose, it's on YouTube, you know, is a blessing and a curse. I am so grateful that this didn't exist when I was a young artist, because there were a lot of concerts.
So the audience filled with your 18.
Oh, my God. And there were many concerts I got up and played that I would not want the whole world being able to access at the click of a button. I needed the time. I mean, I wish every concert had been the greatest thing ever, but they weren't. I mean,
well, and there's also, in the last 10, 15, 20 years, the explosion of pianists coming from countries where...
Yeah.
And not just a few. thousands of classical artists coming from countries that never saw any artists on stage.
I know.
In the 70s or 80s.
Oh, I know. Yeah. You know, I was in China. I did a recital tour there 3 years ago. And I did some master classes at the university in Shanghai. And someone told me that currently there are 20,000 young pianists in conservatories. 20,000. So are they all hoping to have a career in music? It's not going to happen.
No.
It's not going to happen.
No. I'm sure the long effect still is there.
Exactly.
The reality has to be setting in at some point.
One would hope. I worry about all those young pianists who... I'm so grateful I have a career. It's hard.
Yeah, well, everyone has to be their own cottage industry, too. Now there's no big recording contracts. I
mean, yes, well, that's a huge thing, right?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you got to, the Prokofievs first turned up on Arabesque.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you got to do that for a small label,
but
there was decent distribution and sort of filtering out to radio stations and whatever. Record stores that used to exist.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, you had avenues. But now everyone has to really do it themselves. So.
They do. It's a different world.
It is a different world.
Mm-hmm.
My guest, Anne-Marie McDermott, is a longtime member of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Here from a Grammy Award-winning CD set of chamber music by Claude Debussy, she performs with, again, past Cadenza guest, cellist Fred Sherry, Debussy's Nocturne and Scherzo. Mm-hmm.
Last thing, we'll go back to this deathbed bucket list.
Yeah.
You said Haydn. I read somewhere Scriabin.
Yes. I am dying to play all the Scriabin sonatas. I've played some of them.
Yeah.
I've been fantasizing about this project for a number of years. One of these years it'll happen. But I want to explore not only the music in these 10 sonatas, but also the synesthetic relationship somehow. You know, and there have been projects that are these cross-genre projects, and I've yet to see one that I felt is successful. You know, of whether it's, you know, special lighting and the music or whatever. I've had some wonderfully provocative, stimulating conversations with a couple of artists about ways to do this, but nothing has yet really felt right. So, but beyond that, I'm recording a bunch of Mozart piano concerti now, and I'm doing something really fun. I got inspired when I recorded some Haydn concerti. What was that, 4 years ago, where I was having dinner with Charles Warren, and one night, and I was talking to him about Haydn and this upcoming recording, and he's a huge Haydn nut himself. And I said, Charles, there isn't any way you'd want to write me cadenzas for the G major concerto. And he did, as a gift.
Yeah.
He delivered them here. They're brilliant. So I've been asking a couple young composers to write me cadenzas. Like, there's a composer I'm very fond of, Chris Rogerson, former Curtis guy himself. A wonderful composer. Chris is, like, I think doing his thesis on Mozart piano concerti. And to have someone young like that commenting on a Mozart piano concerto through writing a cadenza is so exciting to me. And
yeah, we've broadcast his stuff because the young and very talented Ataka String Quartet are really big promoters of his.
Okay.
They've performed his works, and we've broadcast them, and which is nice. Interconnectivity of everything these days is really pretty cool.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah. Are you kidding? Yeah. That was something that nobody told me before I started with my career. The interconnectedness of everything, and that when you're a musician, and especially as each decade goes by, this sense of belonging to this family is so vivid and so strong and gives you this foundation every day that all of your colleagues, that they're out there, even if you don't talk to each other for a couple of years, that's that connection.
Right.
It really is family. You know? Well, it's great.
We look forward to anything you do. But you know,
oh, thank you.
Keep ticking off the bucket list.
Okay. Thank you. Well, you know what's cool, by the way, is so I'm not only recording Haydn and Mozart as these ongoing projects, but Paul Reuters, the legendary Danish composer, he wrote his third piano concerto for me. It's called Paganini Variations, and it has a little bit of a story. It was commissioned as a guitar concerto. David Sterabin.
This all connects up to Bridge Records.
It does. It does.
David and Becky Sterabin.
Absolutely. And so David had commissioned Paul Reuters for this guitar concerto called Paganini Variations. After it was premiered, and it is devilishly difficult on the guitar, David started feeling guilty that this piece is not going to have a real life as a guitar concerto. So he talked to Paul. Paul and I met, and Paul decided he wanted to write it as a piano concerto for me. So I have a recording of that coming out. I recorded it last year, actually less than a year ago, with the Odense Philharmonic in Denmark. And so that's going to be released in the fall, and also going to be released in the fall is a recording I made a while ago. It's just been sitting in the can of Warren's fourth piano sonata.
All right.
That's going to be coming out. So I'm very excited about those two projects. It's not just Mozart and Haydn.
Well, it's good that a composer like Charles Warren has a champion like you.
I mean,
you know.
Yeah. He's worth it.
Yeah.
He's worth it.
I close on my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which just says if you could chat with someone from the past or you never had a chance to. Now, I should tell you that one of your cohorts in crime, Nadia Sornow-Sonnenberg, way back in the second year of this program, I think she was performing with NJSO.
Okay.
Up to that point, when I'd asked this, these got composers, and over the years, Bach is the number one runaway answer. But she was the first one to step outside.
Oh, I can just imagine. What did she say?
Well, she said, Jesus Christ, she wanted to see if all the hype was true. So, but I've had, since that, I've had everybody from Jesus Christ to Gandhi to Groucho Marx, but usually it's a composer. So, not that you're going to top Nadia, but when I asked that, of course, your mind floods. But when I said that, what was the first thing that popped in? Somebody you just loved to
It would be Carl Jung.
Carl Jung.
Yeah. He's, you know, a philosopher.
Yeah.
I'm a big philosophy nut, and especially Eastern philosophy. I spent like 10 years, that's all I read in my 20s. And there's a great book called Conversations with Arau, with Claudio Arau. And the final part of the book Arau is talking about psychotherapy and the importance of this in a musician's life, and about his obsession with Eastern philosophy and with the philosophy of Carl Jung. So I started down the path of reading Carl Jung. And that got me completely hooked on Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, and that took 10 years of my life, like this obsession. So I would just love the opportunity of like having a big, long evening with Carl Jung and kind of just hearing him talk about his philosophy of archetypes and humanity and karma and all of this. Since you qualified it by telling me it could be outside the composer world.
Sure, it could be anybody. I'm just wondering, from composers, from somebody who you've had under your hands, is there somebody just you had questions for? And just...
Well, I would have loved to meet and spend time with Haydn, because I have a feeling his dramatic world is so huge, okay? The drama in his writing and the passion and the power for when he lived, but also the humor and the profundity. You listen to the slow movements. And how does somebody create something? I know people say this about Mozart as well, but in the piano sonata realm, Haydn has Mozart topped by 1,000,000%. And how does somebody write something so seemingly simple, so infused with such depth? You know, so I would love to...
Yeah, it would have been a good evening because, as far as we know, everybody liked Haydn.
Yes!
A great personality.
Yeah, yeah.
Which can't be... is not true of everybody in the pantheon of composers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So...
Yeah.
Final question is a non-musical question. Everybody in on Kansas fills their life with music. You're very busy. You've got a 30th anniversary to pull off here in Colorado. But when you have to get away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, respite, what do you do?
Well, I'm a dog person. So for 15 years, I toured with my little Maltese, Samantha. And I got inspired to tour with a dog because I studied with John Browning in my teen years. And John toured with a dog, Tyler. So I lost my angel in January, and then about a month and a half later, I jumped right back in. So now I have Lola.
Okay.
So definitely hanging with the puppy, getting eaten alive. You can see some damage here. I'm showing you my arms. Beyond that, reading. I love reading philosophy. That's like when my husband and I go on vacation, we both have the same goals. Go to a quiet, peaceful place and read. And going to plays. I don't really like musicals, but love provocative plays.
That's Lola.
You can hear Lola in the background, yes.
We should say, when you had your other dog, you used to bring her on stage with you.
I did. I did. And there were some amazing stories of, like, she escaped from backstage. And there was one time I was playing a Haydn piano trio at a church on Cape Cod with my two sisters. And I'm playing, and my brother was supposed to be hanging out with Samantha. Well, he wasn't. And Samantha escaped out the church, came around the whole front of the building, up the big steps in the front, came running up on the altar where we're playing. And I knew if I looked at her, she'd start barking.
Yeah.
So I just continued playing. She just sat there, stared at me. And then when the piece ended, everybody started clapping, then she turned around and took her bows and... So, I mean, I have a million stories. It's just something when you're traveling and spending so much time alone, there's something about having a little therapy in the form of a puppy.
And we should have full disclosure here. We're doing this interview outside of your apartment because inside is Lola Land. We wouldn't have been able to.
Oh, you can't imagine what my living room looks like right now because she has every toy known to dog kind and she's worth it. But.
And Ray McDermott, thanks for taking some time.
Such a great pleasure talking to you. Thanks. Bye.
Pianist Anne-Marie McDermott. You can find out more about her at her website, Anne-Marie McDermott, AnneMarieMcDermott.net. And you can check out all the happenings at the exciting 30th anniversary celebration of the Bravo Vale Music Festival that is running now through August 4th at the website bravovale.org. I'll leave you with my guest performing a composer she embraced and thoroughly recorded years ago, Sergei Prokofiev. This is the finale from his piano sonata number 7 in B-flat major, opus 83, performed by my guest today, Anne-Marie McDermott. As always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you.
Thank you.